I'm now going to read out a paper from Tony Voss in his absence. A great shame that he couldn't be here. It's very much a voice that we look forward to hearing and was an integral part of our discussions. But Tony made the amazing effort of still writing a quite substantial long paper, which I've had to cut down a little bit for him. But this will, I mean, it will serve to contribute some ideas, but also for Australian, maybe some of the, deepen the sense of the poetry culture, or the poetry history out of which Butler was writing in the mid-20th century. Tony Voss's, the university at which he taught, I actually forget, so I can't do a proper introduction for him. But he is a recent arrival, a relatively recent arrival in Australia, and resides here in Sydney. So I speak as Tony. I will focus on the Scots South African colonial poet Thomas Pringle, who, although he came as a settler in 1820, spent only 6 years in South Africa. He was preparing to return to the Cape to resume his South African career when he died of consumption in London in 1834. The year of the abolition of British slavery. We can see in Pringle's oeuvre his problems of what to write and how to write it. Some of his answers he shared with his metropolitan contemporaries, for his fellow South African poets he served as a pioneer. While I don't believe it can be said that Pringle was able to forge new technical and formal means, his choice from the prosodic resources of his British heritage was pointed. As either a Scottish or a South African citizen of the British Imperium, Pringle was inevitably provincial, but not necessarily parochial. Pringle exploited the range of conventional poetic forms and moods of his age, the picturesque, the pastoral, the nostalgic. In the following, I want to recall one of the central contrasts of Horace's Ars Poetica, that between art, art, skill, workmanship, handicraft, and ingenium. Sorry, I have terrible Latin. I don't have any Latin. Natural capacity or ability, talent, genius. That was me, by the way. I want to propose first that in the colonial situation, the colonizing poet associates herself or himself with art and the colonized poet with ingenium. In the apartheid years of South Africa's history, these contrasts, art, ingenium, carried strong ideological implications. For white settler poets in English, who include Roy Campbell, Ruth Miller, Guy Butler, Douglas Livingston, and Afrikaans, M.P. Van Vyck, my apologies to those who know how this would be pronounced, Van Wyck Lou, D.J. Opperman, Elizabeth Ibers, Peter Blum, poetic craft, form, and technique were essentials of their culture. Douglas Livingston was critical of some of his black and other contemporaries for their lack of technique. Among the black poet, H.I.E. Dlomo, whose mother tongue was isiZulu but wrote in English, stuck so closely to the demands of traditional verse forms that he has often been read for his humanist message of resistance and liberation but dismissed as a verbal artist. Dlomo's near contemporary B.W. Vilikazi, writing in isiZulu, tried to adapt traditional English verse forms to his poetry in his mother tongue. Arthur Noerte, the coloured poet who died, explored all the strict forms from a modernist perspective. The range of Pringle's verse suggests that he associated certain measures with particular subjects or attitudes, octosyllabic couplets with the anthropological and picturesque, varieties of the ballad measure with frontier life, the fortina with conversation poems, and the verse epistle, the sonnet, with a conscious inscription of his work into the tradition of Milton and Wordsworth. I will discuss in more detail three poems in an attempt to see these formal choices as application of literary craft in a particular context of intelligibility. So the first is The Bushman. Is that in focus? Yes. Enough? Yeah, it's readable? Okay. The Bushman sleeps within his black-browed den in the lone wilderness. Around him lie his wife and little ones unfearingly, for they are far away from Christian men. No herds, loud lowing, call him down the glen. He fears no foe but famine, and may try to wear away the hot sun slumberingly. then rise to search for roots and dance again. But he shall dance no more. His secret lair surrounded echoes to the thundering gun and the wild shrieks of anguish and despair. He dies, yet ere life's ebbing sands are run, leaves to his sons a curse should they be friends with the proud Christian men, for they are fiends. I'm sorry. Despite some awkward rhyming, Pringle makes good use of the structural resources of the sonnet. The first quatrain paints an idyllic picture of the bushman's solitary home. Idiomatic details acknowledge the common humanity of poet and subject, and are set against the poetic diction of black-browed den in the lone wilderness. The idyll is tenuous, only possible because of its distance from the already ironic Christian men. The second quatrain contrasts the hunter-gathering lifestyle with the poet's pastoral, but links the two at opposite ends of the glen. Negative, acknowledging the music of the bushman's culture. The turn of the sonnet is marked by the negative repetition of dance. The silence of the first quatrain and music of the second give way to the thundering gun and the wild shriek of anguish and despair and curse. Pringle's diction is occasionally powerfully resonant. The bushmen seek to wear away the hot noon in slumber. Roots may have more than one sense in this context. So let's go now to Song of the Wild Bushman. Let the proud white man boast his flocks and fields of fruitful grain. My home is mid the mountain rocks, the desert my domain. I plant no herbs nor pleasant fruits, I toil not for my cheer. The desert yields me juicy roots and herds of bounting deer. The countless springboks are my flock, spread o'er the unbounded plain. The buffalo bendeth to my yoke, the wild horse to my rein. My yoke is the quivering assegai, my rein the tough bowstring. My bridle curb is a slender barb, yet it quells the forest king. I might just skip right to the end. Thus I am lord of the desert land, and I will not leave my bounds to crouch beneath the Christian's hand and kennel with his hounds, to be a hound and watch the flocks for the cruel white man's gain. No, the brown serpent of the rocks his den doth yet retain, and none who there his sting provokes shall find its poison vain. Okay. For his assumption of the voice of the bushman himself, the poet chooses a modified ballad measure, a folk verse form we could associate with the border ballad of his native Scottish lowland. Pringle fashions a dramatic monologue which transposes the terms of the settler's pastoral economy to the bushman's hunter-gathering. The image idealizes the bushman's life and blurs the distinctions on which colonial intrusion rests. The natural and the human, the positive, the desert and the sown, labor and leisure. From the negative of lines 5 to 8, the rhetoric moves to the positive transpositions of lines 9 to 16, which challenge the horse-born culture of the colonist. The first stanza is a rejection of the proud white man. Stanzas 2 and 3 offer an affirmation of the hunter-gatherer economy. And the final stanza moves into the future with a defiant assertion of the perpetual right to land. Can I just make one point as I go on? Tony had not read Jared's paper before writing this paper, just so you're aware of that. He had to write it before he was able to read a draft. In this context, the irony of the speaker's situation emerge. I am lord of the desert land, repeats the claim to the desert my domain, part of the effect of which is to register that only to the desert can the bushman make any claim. This is the price, perhaps, at which the bushman can remain free of the Christian subjection. The irony comes out strongly in I will not leave my bounds. Even as he claims the right to his land and his determination to remain, the bushman acknowledges that he is confined to his bounds, which are both his space and his limits. He will not leave his possession, also in the sense that he will not bequeath it to a following generation. The poet sees, perhaps, what he does not allow his subject to see. In effect, the hunter-gatherer, whose people never hold clients, servants, or slaves, contemplates a guerrilla war of resistance against proletarianization. Tony would have followed this, if he had had time, with a poem called Makana's Gathering by Pringle, which is about being called to war, a Xhosa call to war against the British in an attack on Grahamstown in 1819. I think it's the British. Correct me if I'm wrong. Pringle's was the historical moment of the intensification of the colonization as the coming of the British was to tilt the balance of power irreversibly in favor of the white man. Yet the struggle continued through industrialization, modernization, and into the post-colonial era. One of Pringle's most distinguished successes was Roy Campbell, a modernist devotee of poetic craft. By his time, the indigenous people had largely been proletarianized, and he at one moment in 1926 foresaw a reaction not in guerrilla or all-out war, but in revolution. So this is the poem, The Surf. His naked skin closed in a torrid mist that puffs in smoke around the patient hooves. The plowman drives a slow somnambulist, and through the green his crimson furrow grooves. His heart more deeply than he wounds the plain, long by the rasping share of insult torn, red clod, to which the war cry once was rain, and tribal spears, the fatal sheaves of corn, lies fallow now. But as the turf divides, I see in the slow progress of his strides over the toppled clods and falling flowers the timeless, surly patience of the surf that moves the nearest to the naked earth and ploughs down palaces and thrones and powers. The hero of this sonnet is thought of by most commentators as Zulu, but Campbell identifies him by his function as ploughman, implicitly as tribesman, and by his timeless, surly patience as a serf, acknowledging the context post-1917 and post-1922, the year of the South African white miners' strike, giving the poem its title, and despite the red earth of Natal, suggesting a mundane global political concern, something wider than colonial apprehension, and an instance of the mythic resonance of Campbell's best verse. The medium of the serf's power is the plough, which is also the instrument of his labor. Its power is in its resonance, in its ingenium, as much as in its art. The craft of the sonnet, although inseparable from its inspiration, is clear. The rhythm captures the steady plod of the ploughman and carries as a syntax of the octave overruns, the volta, a frisson of apprehension in the poet. The periodic sentence of lines 5 to 9 requires a more intense attention than a tableau of lines 1 to 4. With the rhythm too, the poem is moving from the sight of a figure in a landscape into the poet's communion with the ploughman's heart and into a vision of the future. Yet all is in the present tense, as if the prophet-poet understands and warns that the fall of the last line is implicit in the ploughman's drive and its flowers fall. Empires collapse. Like Pringle's bushman, the serf's identification with nature is an aspect of his strength. His skin is naked and his heart is crimson like the earth. His heart is no longer nourished by the warrior order. Although his people's culture and traditional economy have been suppressed, he is patient like the animal that draws his plow, but in his somnambulism, there is progress to catastrophe. Details of diction locate the picture in a particular landscape without muting the wider resonance. And finally and quickly, Herbert Flomo, another Natal poet and near contemporary of Campbell, wrote verse, drama, journalism, and short stories. He was a teacher. Librarian, reporter, activist, and musician. This poem appeared in Langa Lase Natal, a Durban bilingual newspaper in the 1940s, South Africa. Thy beauty is not for me. My home is not my home. I am an outcast in my land. They call me happy while I lie and rot beneath a foreign yoke in my dear strand, mid these hills and dales, under these stars, to live and to be free, my father's fort. Must I still fight and bear anew the scars? Must freedom e'er with blood and sweat be bought? You ask me whence these burning words and wild, you laugh and chide and think you know me well. I am your patient slave, your harmless child. You say, so tyrants dream as even they fell. My country's not my own, so I will fight. My mind is made. I will yet strike for right. The poetic diction has not substantially changed since Pringle's. Perhaps Tolomeo was over-influenced by the traditional Romantic and Victorian English literature syllabus of his mission education. Nonetheless, I find power in this poem. The structural resources of the Shakespearean sonnet are effectively disposed as the poem moved from the protest of the first quatrain into reminiscence and questioning of the future in the second. In the third quatrain, the poet addresses an interlocutor who seems to be an equal, addressed as you rather than thee, but is gradually identified as his oppressor, master, parent, tyrant. The conversation is broken off by the speaker, and the closing couplet moves into the future and the poet's commitment to fight. Thank you on behalf of Tony.